Her mind is aglow with whirling, transient nodes of thought, careening through a cosmic vapor of invention.
Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J. For the next half hour, keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left as we present a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. I'm speaking today with Athena Andriadis. She's a neurobiologist at the University of Massachusetts and the author of The Biology of Star Trek, and we're meeting here in Seattle at a futurist confab.
Well, I'm very glad to be talking to you, James, of all kinds of interesting things which you've already touched upon in this rather intense workshop.
We've been talking about the future of the human body today, and so hopefully we'll not be too redundant, but why don't you tell me a little bit about, because I still don't have a very clear idea about what you do on the bench. What exactly is it that you do as a neurobiologist?
Well, actually, I do something very orthodox. I'm a molecular biologist who is looking at a very basic gene regulatory mechanism. And I've used as a model system a gene that keeps your neurons happy. If that gene does anything incorrect, you get dementia. But I use it as a handle, really, to see the reality of the mechanism, which is called alternative splicing. It turns out that nature spliced before humans and in much more imaginative ways. So, for example, when we had, remember the moratorium on recombinant DNA briefly in Cambridge? Well, if the moratorium had been real and enforced, all life but bacteria would have ceased in Cambridge for a while.
Because they were actually, the natural processes were doing what they tried to ban.
Exactly. But so in that respect, I'm very much a mainstream molecular neuroscientist.
Mm-hmm. So that could be said of cloning as well, since there's natural cloning, which we call twinning.
Not only that, actually, you can also propagate. For example, that's how people propagate the rose bushes. Mm-hmm. They actually cut a slice and grow it to the whole organism.
Do you think that there is a gene therapy application out of the work that you're doing?
Yes, there might well be, in that this particular gene has been found mutated in dementia pedigrees, so the answer is yes. The only trouble with a lot of these, again, is the fine-tuning of the process rather than anything else.
Mm-hmm. You're Greek. You came here when?
I came here when I was 18.
And we were just joking that you were attracted to topics about exobiology because you feel like an alien in this country. Is that a serious joke on your part, or?
Well, you know what is interesting to me, actually? If you shift cultures and you're equally immersed in both, you end up having this disturbing double vision. If you're embedded in a single culture, you take a lot of things for granted. If you shift, it's like, you know, remember the faces that are a vase? Sometimes they're a face and sometimes they're a vase. It's the same thing. So a lot of assumptions that are made if you are in a uniform environment, like a single culture all your life, you see, they don't hold the moment you go over the borders somewhere else. So I do feel alien, and now I feel alien in both cultures because I have had the double vision, and you cannot revert to the single vision after that has happened.
Did you start watching Star Trek when you were in Greece or when you came here?
Actually, I did not know of Star Trek before I came here. When I came here in college, it was the original series was in reruns. But what was amazing about that, the thing that impressed me, was two things impressed me about it. One was that people never quarreled about watching it. That is, you know, in the other time slots, people were saying, no, I want to watch this, I want to watch that. Well, that one, there was no dissent. It was Star Trek, period. But the second thing that was astonishing to me was the fact that during the breaks, they would actually discuss the feasibility of the ideas, you know, the scientific feasibility of the ideas that were presented in the show. And, you know, for me, who was a budding scientist, I had assumed that this would actually be the way real scientists would be talking about it, instead of saying, oh, you know, the departmental politics and the nitty-gritty of getting grants and, you know, how much more hard-nosed can you be than the next person? How many decimals are in your quantitations?
You're looking for the romance.
The swashbuckling I was looking for, yes, no question about it. I mean, I see science as, you know, and again, this is, you're right, it's a romantic idea, but it's a swashbuckling ideal that drew me to it, the idea of the discovery, you know, of going where no one has gone before. The exploring aspect, I mean, the rest is like, it's okay, I can understand everything. And of course, I understand the idea of rigor. You know, you have to be intellectually correct. You have to follow where it leads you. You should not fall in love with beautiful theories unless they are correct, i.e. borne out by your observations. But the idea of being the astrogators of humanity is what made me a scientist.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, your book, The Biology of Star Trek, obviously, since you're a biologist, that was one of the things you'd write about. Is this book a part of the canon of exobiology? Are you concerned with the topics, the actual speculation about what kind of life might exist in other planets, or are you more concerned with just how it's presented in the book, in the Star Trek universe?
I don't think that I'm really only interested in the Star Trek universe because I consider the Star Trek as a handle, really. It's a handle for forays into questions. Absolutely, I used it as a launching pad to discuss, as you say, alternatives for life, you know, or our limitations. If we go out there, what will happen to us when we do? Mm-hmm. So I very much, it's a stealth science book in many ways. But definitely not the universe. I mean, the universe itself is neither here nor there, but it what makes you think is the big deal, the important thing.
I'm speaking with Athena Andriadis, and this is Change Surfer Radio. Athena is the author of The Biology of Star Trek. One of the things that you talk about in your book, The Biology of Star Trek, is the snuggleability quotient in Star Trek. Can you tell us a little bit about that? I mean, I think it's obvious to many people that it's difficult to do a show where there would be forms of life that would be radically different from human beings, and so they generally just put some prosthetics on people's faces. But
right.
Yeah.
Actually, there are two separate issues, and one has to do with the limits of technology. Nowadays, there's very good graphics, and you can actually do radically different forms as long as so you don't have to use human actors. But I was referring to something deeper than that, and that is the idea of what humans find attractive in not just physically, but what they will feel emotionally close to or intimate with. Remember, there were these famous monkey experiments with the baby monkeys. There was one wire model that gave them milk and one that didn't, but that was covered with soft cloth, so they went for the snuggles. So the idea of snuggability has to do with who we feel comfortable snuggling with. You know, we're mammals. You know, we're made to do that. I mean, that's part of what makes us human now. So the general idea is that, you know, we our strings in film and other situations can be pulled by the SQ quotient. I mean, whatness are children and how they look? You know, the round face, the round eyes, the big, the long eyelashes. And
VW Volkswagen is shaped like a baby.
Absolutely, and that's why people love it. I mean, I think Volkswagen is savvy.
How does that reflect on the Tribbles episode? I mean, this is like the classic snuggleability, but they were also a threat. Was that part of the kind of dynamic tension of that?
Perhaps, but in that case, you're actually dealing with also, you must notice they don't have faces. They're just, you know, muffs. Right. They're little muffs. Yeah. But, you know, even so, you could see that it was a light, that was played for laughs. Mm-hmm. They never said, well, what, you know, like releasing rabbits in Australia, they're very sweet and cute, but they really devastated the continent. Mm. So eventually they had to do something about it. I mean, the cats sort of took care of it. But you can see how it even plays against some long-term enlightened self-interest if you choose to do this kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. There isn't very much experimentation in the Star Trek universe with non-carbon-based life forms. And in fact, there's one episode in The Next Generation where they track down the primal genetic structure of the Romulans and the Vulcans and the humans, and it turns out that we were all seeded from some
right.
primal humanoid base, which was a nice explanation for why, you know, you found people who could speak English all over the universe. But
that's different. That's called Southern California. That's something else. It's like we go into matters of budget. But you know what's interesting about all this, actually? The question of hybrids and how far you can go, how far you can go being cousins before you stop being cousins. Now, for that one, generally, I would say that the one thing that Star Trek always bungles, always, all every single episode of theirs that had to do with evolution was wrong. Like, they're Lamarckists. Like, you walk into a force field and suddenly you're evolving into something else. Mm-hmm. You evolve so fast that, in fact, you become unrecognizable, whether it's psychic powers or something physical. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, you can't mutate that fast. A grown organism can do that. Mm-hmm. Period.
They have an idea in some of the episodes that species will reach a kind of transcension point, and they have the idea in the Next Generation of Q as a kind of an evolved godlike being. Mm. You know, is that we've been talking today about the notion that human evolution may be subject itself to evolution, and that we may be there may be an exponential rate to change. So can you talk about that a little bit? I mean, the ways that Star Trek might be projecting that there is a transcending of the ordinary evolutionary process.
Well, I think the series, and rightly so, given what it is and its audience, projected audience is and has been, is decidedly middle brow. So their sense of transcendence seems to be like entities that basically resemble the ancient pagan gods. They look the same. They have the same desires. They have children. They can love and hate and be angered just like humans, except they also can travel through time and space and all of that good stuff. So in that respect, it's fantasy, not science fiction or science. I would say that for true transcendence, if it happens, we have actually discussed today a number of ways it could go, but I think the end result would be very different from that. And an entity that truly can be, if you wish, four-dimensional rather than three-dimensional is clearly not going to look like Q. Mm-hmm. Although, you know, I agree he's cute. Still, you know what I mean.
Well, Q didn't really look like Q. I mean, Q was something like, you know, space dust.
Q was actually, yeah, I mean, it sounds like it was a continuum that chose to occasionally coalesce into something else, yeah. Which is, it's all right. Again, I think the limits of imagination are what precluded this, you know, that and the idea that, it became a franchise, they had to play it safe. Oddly enough, the first round, although the effects were cheesy, to begin with, I mean, they knew they were cheesy, they grappled with larger ideas, and they had better writers, Harlan Ellison, mm-hmm. Theodore Sturgeon, and Blish, and so forth. Then it became professionalized, so it grew up, and it became serious, and it became safe.
Yeah. One of the episodes from the first series that I think for exobiological purposes was really pathbreaking was the episode with the silicon-based life form that was crawling through the planet and eating its way through. Can you talk a little bit about, what your exobiological speculation is about non-carbon-based life and whether Star Trek sometimes gets it right that way?
Actually, I thought that was, rightly so, it's one of the most famous episodes, no question. For one thing, they do grapple with a non-carbon life. Definitely, and they do not a bad job. Now, as far as life out there and what it might be, I think anything that resembles us, even remotely, will have to be carbon-based for a very simple reason. Carbon is by far and away the most versatile of elements in terms of what it can interact with, what kind of chain complexity it can form. The second thing is that water is the best solvent universally, period. You can do backup systems, like you can have silicon with fluoride, but then fluoride is very, very rare as an element. You can have ammonia as a solvent, which is almost as good as water. So, but on the other hand, I mean, you could have intelligent plasma clouds. You may, except I don't know how we would communicate with them and tell them that we are also conscious and that they would tell us what their time frames are. And so forth.
How we could recognize each other.
Exactly. In fact, if it's at the borders of the very exotic, the very advanced, or a very primitive when you have question marks. I mean, if something comes up to you and tries to shake your hand, you know what's happening. Mm-hmm. If something tries to do something complicated, like, you have Solaris is, a classical example. So is this sentient or not? And if it is, what is it trying to tell us? Mm-hmm. Or think of the fact that even here on Earth, if we have an unknown language, we cannot decipher it unless we have some kind of key, some kind of cheat sheet like the Rosetta Stone or something. Mm-hmm. Here, with humans who have the same motivations that we do, I mean, something that's that different.
Right. So are you a pessimist about SETI?
Actually, for that one, I'm more pessimistic about recognizing I'm more pessimistic about recognizing a bona fide signal, because one of the criteria, for example, is that it has to occur more than once. It's unlikely that that will happen. So we may actually have false negatives, for one. Mm-hmm. Now, the question of decoding is also a very – it's not trivial. I agree that, yes, if they're sentient and if they think like us, they will probably send mathematics. They'll send Fibonacci series or something like that. Mm-hmm. But – or again, if they don't send some kind of key, and you know, cryptographers think about stuff like this, you know, the single key, the double key, and so forth. But they really have to think like us. Mm-hmm. I mean, look at humans and you know, all these tragedies, first contact situations, and somebody does something that's perfectly okay for their culture, and the other side is like, they've just offended the gods.
Right. Sticking out your tongue is a hello greeting for the Tibetans and exactly. Things like that, yeah. One of the things that's always bugged me about Star Trek is that here we're projecting 200-300 years in the future, and everyone still lives 100 years. And they have this technology where they can take a part of the body and beam it someplace mm-hmm. and apparently store it as an energy pattern in a computer buffer.
Right.
And yet everyone's dying all the time. I just right. I don't get that.
I think, again, you know, they haven't followed things through. I think the transporter, the way they describe it, cannot be done for humans. But ignoring that for a moment, mm-hmm. you're right. I mean, basically, as I said, I mean, I wrote this in the book. I have a chapter on the transporter, and I'm very grumpy about it. And it's like, all you have to do, you're right, it's like, not only that, the same thing can be used for things like reversal of aging, right? Or you want a better-looking nose. You store your pattern, you fiddle a little with it, and then you say, okay, this is the pattern, bring it back, and it looks slightly different. And in fact, they have used this device when, you know, there's these bizarre divisions, right? The evil versus good, the this right. versus that. So in the end,
they used it to filter out disease once.
Exactly, precisely. And so all of this, again, it's well, if it's a plot device, it's okay. I once was talking to one of the science writers, and I said, well, how do you do the science? And he said, well, they send me the script, and it says, insert X tech here. You know? So it's not very high on the agenda to have verisimilitude about mm-hmm. or even consistency mm-hmm. in terms of the functions and roles of all these different magical devices.
Isn't there kind of an implicit vitalism about it, that you can only have one body with one soul, even if you take it apart and you put it back together? I mean, the notion that they have so rarely explored the idea of duplicate copies.
They did actually. In Deep Space Nine, remember that they have Will Riker and Tom Riker. Mm-hmm. When there is a split, and the two have diverged, in fact, and one of them is the Starfleet darling, and the other is a Maquis. He's a rebel. And so they haven't actually, I thought those were very good episodes, because they tried at least to grapple with this. It's like, there you have it. You've had a twinning mm-hmm. that it has happened. But I think the one thing, for example, they haven't come in terms with is that if you're transporting it and you're taking care of it on that end, and that it has the memories of the original and so forth, the original on this side, then you have to end up with a corpse, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So what you have over there is a perfect copy, but it's not the original mm-hmm. at the arrival point. Mm-hmm. So of course, if you say, well, it's a perfect original, it has all the memories and so forth, but it's still a perfect copy. Mm-hmm. It's not the original, mm-hmm. which is very disturbing.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And in fact, they explore that now in the current Star Trek franchise, because their people are still afraid of right. transporting themselves.
As they should be.
Well, one of the things, another thing that's bothered me about Star Trek is that although they introduced the idea of Khan leading a kind of eugenic super race and having a global war around about now, where we try to put him back in his bottle and we send him out into space, there are humans all over this galaxy colonizing all these different planets, and yet almost none of them have been exploring these kind of human enhancement possibilities. And again, in Deep Space Nine, you have the explicit idea that it's illegal to yes. enhance intelligence.
I agree. And in fact, oddly enough, I would say the eugenics wars, first of all, those people don't look that much different or better. Mm-hmm. So they had a very bad eugenicist working for them.
He had psychic powers, but that was the only
exactly.
thing.
Exactly. But I agree with you that it is astonishing to me that the uniformity of the social, cultural, political systems, everywhere they go, there's global government, there's one language, you know, there's one exception I can think of. There was one episode where there was the rebels against authority and so forth and so on. The rest is all like the same.
So they have gone way back from those.
Bajor was a more complicated culture than human civilization all across the galaxy seemed to be.
Absolutely. There's no question. And when you think of the distances involved, even if you assume you have warp drive, it doesn't matter. It's still hundreds of years distances. They would have evolved to completely different paradigms, mm-hmm. biologically, culturally, politically, religiously, every way you want to think about it. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. No question.
You also talk in your book about prudishness, and there's a pervasive heterosexuality. They only touch on it once in The Next Generation, where one of the worms that has a shared consciousness with a body falls in love with the doctor, who's a woman, and then it dies, and it goes eventually into the body of another woman. And then she says, oh, you know, I could be in love with an alien who had a worm in his belly, but I can't be in love with you as a woman, you know?
Yeah, that was one of my biggest disappointments, although later they actually partly redeemed themselves in Deep Space Nine, where they did have a case of two symbionts loving each other in the bodies.
Oh, through a variety of different bodies.
Right. That's right.
So I agree with you. They are, they're exceedingly prudish, and there's no male homosexuality at all, which is, you know, it's like, you know, the guys have to be alpha males, you know, they have to run around impregnating, you know, as many.
Which is a huge irony, since there's this enormous subculture of slash fiction of women who write homoerotic love stories between Absolutely. Different Star Trek characters.
I agree, and it's a pity in a way, because, you know, this thing is so popular that they could actually take it out. That is, you know, they could play with all of these things because it's so secure in its footing. Mm-hmm. And people would actually accept it, I think, because they can. There's no reason.
Buffy the Vampire Slayer got away with it.
Absolutely. And a few other things, and which were a very successful series, got away with, you know, not necessarily being, I mean, television is television, and they can only go so far, but they went further than that. Mm-hmm. And it was on, I mean, everything is, for me, Star Trek really is a contemplation of middle-class America. That's what the series is. It shows you the preoccupations and the interests of middle-class America, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, the four mm-hmm. series. Mm-hmm. And that's pretty much what it is in many ways.
What do you think of the current series?
I don't watch it very much. And in fact, I didn't watch Voyager because it really irritated me. It was too new age, despite the fact that finally they had enough women and they had a woman captain. That was.
But a Native American assistant captain, whatever his position was,
right.
That was kind of, yeah, okay.
Yeah. It was. I mean, it's obvious. That's one of the things.
Right.
It was like, it's too obvious. But the current one, so I don't watch it enough to have formed an opinion, although I think the idea of things not working as, you know, not being perfected is an interesting one. But then most of the episodes I've seen commit the cardinal sin of being boring, you know. And when all is said and done, they can't be boring. Also, given what you see of the characters, there's still not enough to draw you in. There's not enough story behind them to say, I'm interested in this person and their dilemmas. Like, here's, again, a lone Vulcan in the middle of things. Her people are not happy about it. Mm-hmm. They don't know what these barbarians are doing. And she's like, well, I have to meditate. And it's like, okay. You know, so what's new?
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
So I would like to see more of that. That would be interesting. Because we already, it being a prequel, we know what to expect
right.
in terms of technology, if you wish.
I'm equally disappointed. I think they could have pushed the boundaries a lot more. Now, you're working on a book right now. You're kind of a critic of the terraforming crowd, and you're working on a book about the ethics and politics of settling other planets. Can you tell us a little bit about what your themes are for that?
Well, the themes are, I've sort of made it a journey, like the arc of a journey, right? The idea is that you will go, if you go out into long generation starships, and you will reach a landing place, and the landing place will be not necessarily, you know, if you go that distance, it's unlikely you will just go for exploration once you go past the solar system. You are going there to stay. If you stay, what is going to happen? No single planet is going to be identical to Earth. I'm not 100% a naysayer on terraforming. All I'm saying is that terraforming is a brute force response, especially when, you know, you hear people saying, well, we will just put these big mirrors and then we'll explode a few nuclear warheads and so forth. And it's like, are we talking about a planet with an ecosystem here? I mean, what exactly are you proposing? I think that you have to have nuanced responses to a complex situation. The other point is that unless you want to be tourists or goldfish in a bowl, if you're going to live in that planet, you cannot live underground, you cannot live in domes, you have to be able to live in the open. Otherwise, it's a prison. It's not a new world. So that means that you have to adapt to it, although you can bring it. I mean, if you go to a place that has an ammonia atmosphere, you cannot adapt, mm-hmm. period. We're talking about the famous M-class planet business. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So if you have something that can be remotely close to it, it's probably easier for us to adapt than to change the planet, because the planet has come to this configuration after a whole set of events. So have we, mind you, to be where we are. But in some respects, you know, if you want to stay unchanged, why leave in the first place? Mm-hmm. Stay here. You know, I mean, the change, the idea is it's the same. If people, you know, people who left and went to Hawaii and still dressed in wool died of heat prostration. Or, you know, if you go to Paris, you should try their cooking. You shouldn't go.
We would have to change pretty radically to live on the surface of Mars, though.
Well, yes, Mars is, for example, Mars does not have oxygen. It would be the equivalent of living in the depths of the ocean. Same idea. Pressure is very different. There's no breathable atmosphere. I'm thinking more of a place that is some approximation where with, you know, but you're right. I mean, Mars is not really an Earth-like planet. It may have been like Earth when it was close in the habitable zone, but not now. So for that one, frankly, I think if we do live on Mars, it probably will be underground with forays above ground. I don't really see it being able to be terraformed, frankly. I mean, you say, well, with infinite resources, yes. I mean, you have Kardashev level 2 and you have the resources of a whole solar system, yes. But if you simply want to do what is now feasible, now meaning the next 200 years, it would have to probably be underground. With forays on the surface for exploration.
Athena, it's been a delight talking to you. I've been speaking with Athena Andriadis. She's a neurobiologist at the University of Massachusetts and the author of The Biology of Star Trek. When can we expect your next book?
As soon as my agent can get a publisher for it.
Okay. Listen up out there.
Yeah, for me, it's, you know, it's already in my mind. It's created. It's in there. All that I need to do is commit it to paper.
Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure discussing all these things with you.
Techno Liberation by Greg Egan. It is not true that the map of freedom will be complete with the erasure of the last invidious border. When it remains for us to chart the attractors of thunder and delineate the arrhythmias of drought, to reveal the molecular dialects of forest and savanna as rich as 1,000 human tongues, and to comprehend the deepest history of our passions, ancient beyond mythology's reach. So I declare that no corporation holds a monopoly on numbers, no patent can encompass zero and one, no nation has sovereignty over adenine and guanine, no empire rules the quantum waves, and there must be room for all at the celebration of understanding, for there is a truth which cannot be bought or sold, imposed by force, resisted, or escaped. Techno Liberation by Greg Egan.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about today's show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, that's J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3, thanks to the A Infos Radio Project. Also, at www.changesurfer.com are instructions on how to order copies of our shows and myriad relevant links. So educate, agitate, and organize. And I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.